I can state this with authority. Nothing compares with deciding to die. I had an excellent plan, and it made me smile. It made me drift more lightly on my air flotation bed. I was an unbeloved monster. No one would mourn my loss. For all intents and purposes, I was already gone. Who would miss me?
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. This week, author Andrew Davidson reads from his much-hyped new novel, The Gargoyle. How hyped is it? After a crazed bidding war, this first novel is being published in 26 countries. Expect to see it soon in airport bookstores. The Gargoyle is loaded with bestseller elements, like burn victims, time travel, medieval puzzles, and the licking flames of eternal love. It's about a porn star who nearly immolates himself in a car accident. As he recovers in hospital, a mystical fellow patient informs him they were lovers hundreds of years ago. He was a mercenary, and she was a runaway nun, secretly translating Dante's Inferno. Now she's a possibly insane sculptress. Her specialty is gargoyles. She may yet carve a man out of the monster the hero has become. The New York Times called The Gargoyle transportingly unhinged. Davidson's indisputed literary bravissimo is making him one of this fall's most talked about new authors. This reading of The Gargoyle took place in September 2008 at the McNally Jackson Bookstore in New York City.
Thank you very much for coming out, and it's really great to be here. Thank you for doing this for us. And I understand I'm supposed to read something. So the first section that I offer for reading is the suicide section. The narrator of the book is thinking about killing himself. He's been severely burned, and he's in a hospital. And before the accident, his life was pretty horrible. He was an empty, shallow, drug-addicted pornographer. And after the accident, it got even worse, so he just wants to get well enough to be released and put himself out of his misery. What you really need to know about this section is, I think I've pretty much set it up, the only other bit of information that I need to give is that our narrator has a snake living in his spine. In his spine, he has a snake right here. Yeah, probably not a real one, but maybe. You never really know with this novel. So, here we go. The suicide section for New York. There's a gentle sigh which descends like billowing silk upon the soul that accepts its coming death. It's a gentle pocket of air in the turbulence of everyday life. The silk of this feeling flutters. No, flutters is too active a word. The silk settles around you, as if it has been drifting towards the earth forever and has finally found its target. The flag of defeat has been mercifully dropped and, in this action, the loss is not so bad. Defeat itself is defeated by the embrace of defeat, and death is swallowed up in victory. The hiss of the snake fades away, and death touches lovingly, possessively. It's a master who pets the head of a dog, or a parent who consoles the crying child. The hours begin to roll, and the days scarcely separate themselves from the nights. Darkness swells like a beautiful hushed tsunami, and the body craves calming lullabies and final psalms. I can state this with authority. Nothing compares with deciding to die. I had an excellent plan, and it made me smile. It made me drift more lightly on my air flotation bed. I was an unbeloved monster. No one would mourn my loss. For all intents and purposes, I was already gone. Who would miss me? The doctors who pretended to care? Nan did her best to say all the right things, and she showed a hopeful face. But she was kind enough not to lie. I lied to her, though, when I pretended that I wanted to heal. I was perfecting my plan, working on it as the nurses tended to my grossness, their tender hands skittering around my body like the most graceful of insects landing upon feces. Now, a suicide is not something you want to screw up, especially if, like me, you're already facing the prospect of spending your entire life looking like last week's dim sum. The only way to make it worse would be to wind up brain dead or quadriplegic, which can happen if you miscalculate. So let me repeat myself. A suicide is not something you want to screw up. My plan would begin immediately upon release from the hospital, because in the burn ward they watched me too carefully. At the halfway house, there would be no locks or security guards. Why would there be? Those places are designed to put people back into society, not to secure them from it. I still had a few $1,000s stashed away in a bank account under a false name, and this would be more than enough. I'd leave the halfway house, hobble down the street, find a bank, and get this money. At a clothing shop, I'd buy a hooded coat so that I could move about undetected in the land of mortals. And then, a most interesting scavenger hunt would occur. Buying a shotgun would be easy. I'd already decided to approach Todd Trash White, a small-time fence who would gladly sell his grandmother for a buck. Moving a shotgun at a handsome profit would put a shit-eating grin on his pockmarked face, and he'd probably even throw in a few extra cartridges for good measure. The other items would be even easier. Razor blades are available at any convenience store. Rope is found at the corner hardware depot. Sleeping pills at the local pharmacy. Scotch at the liquor mart. After procuring my supplies, I'd check into a hotel. Once alone in my room, I'd take a few antihistamine tablets, although not for hay fever. I'd settle in and watch a few adult movie channels, or a few adult movies on the hotel's blue channel, just for old time's sake. Who knows, I might even see myself in a farewell performance. While watching the movies, I'd crack open the hinge of the shotgun to insert a couple of cartridges. Next, I'd fashion a noose, paying particular attention to the knot. The object is not to strangle, but to break the neck. A large, strong knot facilitates a clean break. Now, having constructed a splendid loop, I'd turn the noose over in my hands a few times to admire my work and pull at it proudly, because you know how men like to yank at their knots. I'd wander out onto the balcony with my gun and my noose, sunset. I'd breathe in the evening air, throw out my arms to embrace the city, bring back my fists and thump them in my chest twice. Feeling strong and manly, I'd fasten the rope securely to the balcony railing. I'd drop the noose over the side, making sure there was ample length for a nice little fall before a sharp, satisfying jerk. Then I'd reel the rope back in, wishing that I could do the same thing to the damn bitch snake in my spine. I'd spin the lid off the pill container and remove 5 sleeping tablets, sailing them down my throat with a glass of scotch. This cocktail would be followed with a few more of the same. It's always nice to enjoy a drink while watching the sun go down. While ingesting these refreshing beverages, I'd remove a razor blade from his package and cut partway through the rope. This operation would involve a certain amount of guesswork. To cut the rope in a way that would not immediately break with the jerk of my fall, I wanted it to hold me, at least for a while, when I reached the end of the line. I'd have another glass of scotch, and another 5 sleeping pills. Now, here's the reason I took the antihistamine. Sleeping pills cause vomiting when taken in excess, and antihistamine counteracts that effect, making sure the sleepy stuff stays down. Pretty smart, huh? Next, I'd take the weekly supply of morphine given to combat the pain snake and inject it in a single satisfying plunge of the syringe. To complete my toxic cocktail, I'd wash down the remainder of my sleeping pills with a final shot of scotch. By now, you can see how my plan is coming together. I'd put the noose around my neck, working quickly because I'd be getting dizzy, Miss Frizzy. I'd take another shiny new razor blade out of its package, see how it sparkles in the light like the wink of an imaginary god. With a single deft stroke, I'd slash my right wrist, deep and clean, and then I'd slash my left wrist in the same manner. Now, this is important. I'd cut along the length of the veins instead of across them. People who cut across the wrists either don't really want to die or just too stupid to pull it off. Now, I'd sit on the edge of the balcony. With bloody hands, I'd lift the loaded shotgun, place the muzzle into my mouth. I'd carefully angle the barrel so that the blast would travel through the roof of my brain and into the meaty gumbo, or roof of my mouth and into the meaty gumbo of my brain. Now, this is the advantage of a shotgun as compared to a handgun, is that your aim doesn't really matter. The 100 pellets will immediately spread out to rip your damn head right apart, and this is a beautiful thing. Now, my body would be positioned back to the city, so that the blast would send me over the edge of the balcony's railing. Now, as my brain was shredded, I'd fall, but this fall would be brought to an abrupt halt by the new snap in my neck, and for a while I'd just kind of hang there, feet bobbing. Well, actually, perhaps I'd jerk around spasmodically, it's hard to say. My wrists would be flowing red, and my skull would be a gooey gray matter mess, something like Picasso's very worst painting, and what was left of my brain would start to starve for oxygen. My stomach would be brimming with scotch and sleeping pills. My veins would run the happily morphing blood right out of the gashes of my wrist. And now, if I cut the rope just right, it would begin to unravel. The braided strands would begin to spin away from each other and, in a few minutes, let go entirely. My body would fall 20 floors to the sidewalk below. Beautiful. Completion. Now that's a suicide that's so much better than a cry for help. Anyway, that was my plan. Never has a man looked forward to his death more than I. But that's the low part of the book. Then Marianne Engel comes and things get better.
Why did you decide to keep the narrator anonymous in terms of not giving him a name? I know that you gave Marianne a name, the doctor, physical therapist, and everybody in the book had a name except the narrator.
Right, that's... You know, it's a very good question, and it's one I get asked a lot. And my answer may sound glib or flippant, but it really isn't. The narrator just really never did tell me his name. And I spent a long time trying to figure out what he should be named, as opposed to Marianne Engel, who, on the first day that she came, she arrived with her name, and she arrived with her look. And a lot of the other names, like Sayuri Mizumoto, like there's meaning built into the names. But in the narrator, it just... I was looking for years for a name for him, and there just came a point maybe 3 years into the process that I said, you know what, I'm pretty comfortable with him not telling me because he doesn't want to give it up, apparently.
I wonder if I could ask. I know that Dante's a big influence on this book. I've also heard it suggested that one of your influences was Valley of the Dolls. I don't know if that's in fact true, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of the many influences that have come into play with this, literary influences.
Yeah, well, Valley of the Dolls I've not read. I may be the only person who hasn't with the number of books that it's sold, but, you know, talking about influences I think is a tricky thing because I can say that my favorite writer is Thomas Hardy. And it is. But I don't write anything like Thomas Hardy. I also like Tom Robbins, who maybe I do have a bit more of a leaning towards, just because he's... What I like about him is he's so playful in the language. It's when I read Tom Robbins, it seems to me like every sentence that he's writing is an adventure that he's embarking upon, and he can't wait to see how it turns out at the period, you know? Kind of, I think that for any writer, they're this sum total of life experience. And I mean, I could throw out Frankenstein, for example, I think is an influence on this. I think that Jean Cocteau's movie La Belle et la Bête, Beauty and the Beast, is an influence on this. I think the Disney version of Beauty and the Beast is an influence on this. I'm a really big fan of the Polish filmmaker, and if anybody actually speaks Polish and knows how to pronounce his name correctly, please forgive me for saying Krzysztof Kieslowski, but I don't know how to say it.
I would have mentioned him in our conversation, too, if I'd known you.
Yeah. Who did Red, White, and Blue in the Decalogue. There's a Swedish singer-songwriter named Rebecca Tornqvist, who I used as an influence for one of the ghost mythic love stories that I wrote in there. I throw in references from Caddyshack and the movie Slapshot that maybe people don't get. I mean, it just comes from all over.
You obviously did a tremendous amount of research for this book, and I was wondering first where your initial idea came from, like where it started, and also, you know, if you have a background in medieval German history or if you just went and looked up all of this. Well, Steph, and finally, why is Marianne Engel always referred to by her first and last name together?
Well, the narrator doesn't have a name, so by giving Marianne Engel both, and then you split the difference, they average one name. So, actually, in the process of editing, I got asked this by my editors as well. One of the three editors was, quite resistant to it, and I put together a list of, I think, six or seven reasons why I made that choice. And they were relatively well thought out, but the final reason was basically just, it feels right. And
it scans so nicely. Marianne Engel. It has right. It has a poetry to it.
Some of the other reasons were, a lot of the religious characters have titles, like Meister Eckhart, and so Marianne Engel works on that level. From a technical standpoint, it was one way of separating the current incarnation, Marianne Engel, from the past incarnation, Sister Marianne, just making it a little bit easier to subconsciously process the difference in time. I had a list of things, but it really just came down to, I liked it, and I sent out an email at one point to all the people involved in the project, and I said, does this bother anybody else, or do you like it? Does it work for you? And the overwhelming response on that was, no, it's great, leave it in. And I said, yeah, okay, I thought it worked well too. So as far as the research, when I get asked if I have advice for writers, one of my sort of standard answers that I really believe is, you should never ever write what you already know. You should really write about what you want to know. And that's speaking from my experience is that research is so important for me, and it takes so long, and it's so intensive that I'm going to be living with this for 2 years. I'm going to be living with medical journals on the treatment of severe burn survivors and the sermons of Heinrich Zuse and Meister Eckhart. And I really need to have an interest in it. I need at the beginning to want to know it. So you ask if I had, any background in medieval Germany or medieval theology or maybe even burn treatment, and the answer is no. But I wanted to learn about these things. So, again, writing to entertain myself or for my own enjoyment, it's, I want to learn about medieval theology. Okay, I'll throw it in my book, and now I have to go out and I have a reason to research it. And it's such an enjoyable part of the process. For me, it's an exercise. Okay, what was life really like then? How were, if you've read the story, that the dwelling that they live in is a big part of that story. And I have to go and say, well, how did they actually build these things? When was Iceland actually settled? Where did the people come from? What did they eat? How did they make beer? Did they have beer? Did they have wine? What did they bring back from the raids? How did the raids work? And putting together the story for me is, putting the words one after another, for me that's kind of the work. And I enjoy it. It's all right. But the research is what I really enjoy.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.